And I'd like now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Marge Devon. She's director of the Tamarind Institute in Albuquerque and artist Toyin Odutola and Sydney Amaral, respectively, from the U.S. and Brazil. Welcome, everybody, to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So, Marge, tell us a little bit about the Tamarind Institute and specifically about this show that you organize and that these artists are participating in. It's called Afro-Black Identity in America and Brazil.
Yes, well, Tamarind Institute is a part of the College of Fine Arts at the University of New Mexico, and we were founded in 1960 to preserve the fine art of lithography, which we are still doing 53 years later.
Amazing.
So we do that through a number of different programs. One is an educational program for training master printers, and another is research, and then, of course, a large part of our program is residencies with artists who are invited here to do special projects like this Afro project that we're involved in now.
And so how did this come together? What you're doing is you're pairing Afro-Brazilian and African-American artists to, first of all, learn and practice lithography, but also to explore identity in these two countries. Was
right.
that your brainchild?
Well, kind of. I actually went to visit with the people at the Bureau of Western Hemisphere Affairs in the State Department, their Office of Public Diplomacy and Public Affairs. Initially, I went to talk to them about supporting a different project, but the U.S. State Department being what it is, they always have their particular interests. And so after we talked a little bit about what I wanted to do, she said that Obama had declared that the year of equity and inclusion, and that they were interested in working with Brazil. So she said, yes. Do you have any thoughts about a way to do a project? And I sat there for about a half a second and said, yes. So I thought what an interesting idea it would be to bring artists, Afro-Brazilian artists here to work with African-American artists and to explore the intersections and the differences in their experiences. They liked the idea, and so they actually funded this project, and we're very grateful to them and to the American Embassy and the consulate in Sao Paulo for their help with this project. So, in fact, I got to travel to Brazil and visit artist studios and identify artists who would be appropriate to bring here for this project. So the exhibition that we have now is work by these artists, both the Brazilians and the American artists, that they did before they came to Tamarind. And the idea was that they would come here and we would create a kind of dialogue between the artists, and they would use that dialogue as a springboard to make lithographs inspired by the kinds of issues that they're talking about. So they're actually collaborating with our master printers to make fine original lithographs. So they're drawing directly on stones and in both cases having relatively new experiences. But because we have our master printers, they take care of all the technical aspects. So all the artists have to do is do what they always do, which is draw.
Now, the exhibition, Afro-Black Identity in America and Brazil, is up through the 31st of August, and it's been up for a while. There's a closing reception this week.
Friday, August 24th, from 5:30 till 7, and it is open to the public. We invite people to come and enjoy the exhibition and meeting both the artists who are here with us today, and we also will have some live Brazilian jazz.
Very nice. So let's now talk to the artists. And by the way, we are joined by translator Roberto Capocchi. Welcome.
Hi.
So the two of you, Sydney and Toyin, have come together and are working on lithography and are working on black identity. And I wanted to ask each of you separately, but let's start with you. Being involved in this Afro-Brazilian African-American collaboration, and you're Nigerian by heritage, and that's where you were born and then raised mostly in the United States. Do you feel that there are common threads aesthetically and historically that come out in the work that you all are doing?
Yeah, I mean, just looking at Sydney's work, I mean,
you know, I don't really know much about Sydney, except for what I've experienced here. But I totally connected with a lot of the motifs that he has in his work. And I think there's always this weird kind of thing where, like, skin cannot really connect to people, but cultures can. And I know that there's a huge Nigerian population in Brazil, but I also understand that he, coming from Brazil, being an African or someone of African descent, there is still these sort of, like, issues surrounding skin. So on the one hand, I'm like, okay, skin can't all connect us. But at the same time, I can understand that as a black man, it's still very difficult in some areas in the world. Well, more than some areas, but, you know, just this idea that it's still an issue that what we look like, what we are, is still very misunderstood. And that can be a problem. And one of the great things about being an artist is that we can show you our perspectives. We can reveal that we are human beings and we do look different. Yes, very much so. But that difference is something that's very beautiful and it adds to the human landscape. So instead of having people constantly pushing away, we're trying to be, again, more inclusive and, like, opening people up to our experiences. So.
Now, you both actually do a lot of self-portraits, and you do portraits of yourself and also people in your family.
Yeah, yeah.
And there are these beautiful... before you start doing the lithography, and we'll talk about lithography in a moment, you were working and are working with pen and ink, especially ballpoint pen.
Yeah.
And when I came, I was thinking, ballpoint pen, gee, what's that gonna be? And they're exquisite, beautiful, very... precise drawings.
Yeah.
Talk about both the... We'll get to the medium in a second, but first of all, talk about the doing self-portraiture and what that means for you.
For a long time, I didn't want to do self-portraits, actually. It wasn't until I got into grad school that I was like, I want to do self-portraits. And I was very wary of self-portraits because I didn't want to come off as narcissistic, or I didn't want to come off as someone a little bit self-obsessed. And I think a lot of that was because during my undergrad, there's a lot of artists around me that were kind of, like, wary of that. It's not a bad thing. It was just kind of, like, I guess being an undergrad, you're just, like, you want to try different things. And going into grad school, there was a huge kind of shift for me personally, and I wanted to sort of document that. I wanted to understand myself a little better, and self-portraiture allows that. You know, you get to really look at yourself, and not just look at yourself, but look at yourself in different situations and different, I don't know, I guess experiences. And through that, you understand yourself a little more. And And that's one of the reasons why I really love to do self-portraits. But it's through that my style really developed, actually. And the sort of, like, detail really kind of came into the forefront when I started doing more self-portraits in grad school. So, and now it's just extended to members of my family and some of my friends when I do portraits. Because I look at people differently now that I've looked at myself and understood certain things. Now I can look at other people differently and notice things that I didn't quite notice before.
So. That's so interesting. Looking at yourself, I mean, do you use a mirror? Do you use photographs?
Oh, all of that, yeah. I think especially now with digital medium, it's really easy to kind of, like, take a photo of yourself or, I don't know, take a capture on your computer or something, you know, and then it's, like, easier to really look at yourself. But I try to be honest about that. I mean, there is a third kind of, you know, there's a screen that I'm looking at constantly, so I'm aware that it's not going to be exactly what I look like, but it's going to be pretty close. So
now you use... a technique and a kind of look that I've never really seen before. And I guess people would have to go to the Tamarind site or come to the show to really see what this means. But a lot of the plane, so to speak, planes of the face look almost like ribbons or almost muscular sinews. Mm. And how did you choose that? Why do you use that way of working?
One of the things that really inspired me, I guess, early on in this style was Chuck Close. I really loved how he talks about how he makes these really complex portraits out of really dumb lines and marks. And I love that idea that, like, you can make something very rudimentary and very simple and create something very complex from that. It's also the same with working with ballpoint pen. This is something that you can go to Walmart and buy for, like, $10 or something. But
a lot of pens.
Yeah, a lot of pens. But this idea that I can take something very simple and create something very complex. And that's kind of how I feel about myself. There's often this very flat and very, well, growing up anyways, there's often this kind of, like, idea of what I was that was very simple and very flat and very rudimentary. And, like, I wanted to show that it's actually very complex and it's very layered. And that's kind of what the work is about, my style is about. taking these sort of very simple marks. I mean, they're kind of the same marks over and over again, but there's a movement, there's a direction, there's a way that they kind of flow depending on the face I'm looking at or depending on the light. And yeah, there's different lights and people have told me that it kind of looks like the night sky in some cases, but that's to me more interesting because it's this idea that from this very simple marking of gradations and shading that you can connote a night sky, you know, like that's kind of what it's about. Like you might see something very simple or it's made up of something very simple, but it is, in the end, something very complex and layered.
We're talking to Toyin Odutola, who is part of this exhibition, Afro-Black Identity in America and Brazil. So you came here to the Tamarind Institute and are now working with lithography, mm-hmm. which is a very, I mean, you're making, in a way, kind of similar motifs, again, portraits of self and family, mm-hmm. but using such a different medium, lithography. Yeah. What is it like to first be doing these pen and ink drawings and then be doing lithography?
It's been really great. I definitely came in very open, not really never working with lithography before, but very curious. And I've just been here like 3 days and I love it. I love the idea that there's not a lot of control. When I work with a pen ink or any sort of very sturdy fine point, you sort of get a little bit I don't have to say it, like anal retentive. You get really like control freaky, and you can't really do that with lithography. You have to kind of work with it, and the crayons that you use are very malleable, and the stone that you're working with is, you know, it's susceptible to change and adjustment. So it's you're kind of more loose, and you kind of let the material kind of guide you sometimes, and then you kind of try to control it. But then you're aware that you can't control so much, and that to me is what I feel like I can take from this experience is that I can't be a control freak all the time. And you can still make beautiful work without having to be so, you know, clean or so this and that. And that's one thing I've really loved. And the idea that there's also different degrees of the crayon, there's like the 0.5. Sydney is talking about the 0.5 to like the 0.1. And the 1 is the greasiest and the softest and the 5 is the hardest. And Sydney's very much got the 5 down. But I remember the first day I was like, okay, this is the closest to a pen, so I have to use the 5. And I started using it. And I noticed that it's very light. And you have to really, like, you know.
Yes.
And I'm used to working like that, working very slowly and, like, spending a lot of time with the pens. And I didn't want to do that with this experience. You know, with this experience, I wanted to kind of work a little faster and kind of, like, really get my hands dirty. So I said, all right, I'm going for the 1. I'm going for the greasiest pen. And it's great. It's really black. It's very rich. I don't think I've ever work with a printmaking like tool that's really rich like that, and it changed the whole texture of my work, and I'm loving it. I really enjoy it.
Let's go now to Sydney Amaral. So you are an artist, and you work also with a lot of self-portraiture and quite a lot of symbolism that is cultural symbolism of Brazil.
É, na verdade, eu trato, eu procuro.
I try to bring elements of Brazilian culture in a way that is not stereotypical, but rather it's the symbolism that is in the minds of Brazilian culture, and that's where I draw. He synthesizes these different symbols.
And some of these symbols are things like banana leaves, and some of these symbols are the gods and deities of northern Brazilian culture. Are you from you're from São Paulo.
Yes.
And so how do you choose the symbols, and what do they mean to you? Are they personal symbols to you, or are they more sort of like overall symbols of your country?
Either from personal experience or from what I come across in the media, and just by life experience.
Tell us about, there's one of the works in the show is Curupira, is that how you say it?
Yes.
Who is that character? That's a character from Brazilian folklore mythology.
Curupira, na verdade, ele faz parte de uma.
The Curupira painting is part of a nostalgia series. The series is about how Brazilians are losing their identity because of foreign influence and other forces. Curupira is a defender of the forest, and he's got his feet backwards to to trick the hunters. But in this series, Curupira is wearing foreign brands on his shoes and his clothing because he's not defending the forest anymore and he's living in a place of deforestation. There are two other paintings in that series. One, Emilia, who is in the lexicon, is a super intelligent ragdoll. In this series, she's on a street corner working the streets. And another one, Saci, that's another traditional Brazilian, mythical Brazilian creature, who's a boy with one leg who lives in the forest and smokes a pipe. In this painting, he's got a prosthetic leg for his second leg, and he's smoking crack.
Ah.
And that's where the name nostalgia comes for the loss of that culture.
It's interesting, I think complicated, to talk about cultural loss in a country that is so multicultural in the first place and has so much foreign influence.
Não, porque nem tanto, porque alguns.
Not necessarily. There are some symbols, as Saci Pererê, Emília, Curupira, from the Sítio do Pica-Pau Amarelo. It's a collection of stories that were very strong symbols, especially for me, and I'm seeing those symbols lose their strength. And I can see that the kids, I'm also a teacher, and I see that kids know Halloween, and they don't know folklore.
Right. So, I've never been to Brazil. What is it like for you as an Afro-Brazilian person in São Paulo, which, as I understand, is more of a European city compared to northern Brazil, which has much more of the Afro-Brazilian music and culture that we here know about?
Acho que em Salvador, eu fui duas vezes para Salvador, percebo que lá a cultura afro é muito mais presente, muito mais forte. Né? Em São Paulo, acho que é mais ou menos como Nova York, a coisa já é muito miscigenada. Então,
yeah, I've been to Salvador, for example, a couple of times, and there's a very strong Afro culture there. São Paulo is more now like New York. It's with a big mix. The Afro culture in Brazil, in São Paulo, is more diluted, but it's resurging now with the new Afro-Brazilian Museum.
Ah, interesting. What? Tell us about that museum.
So this is a project started in 2004 by Emmanuel, who also ran the state Pinacoteca
Museum.
One of the state museums. And the idea was to strengthen Afro culture and promote it, but also to bring it back to its place in the culture of the city of São Paulo. And since 2004, since the museum, black culture in São Paulo has been strengthened, even in roles in the media. There's a stronger sense of citizenship in the Afro community that extends to characters in soap operas, for example, that were always portrayed as maids, and now they are more principal characters.
Very interesting. Tell us about your experience being part of this exhibition here at the Tamarind Institute and working with other Afro-Brazilian, African-American artists. Do you have a sense of common culture, common aesthetics?
Percebo.
Yes, I do sense a similar sense of aesthetic with the use of color, with the use of lighting, and with some of these artists who have been my friends and I have worked with them. He admires Turin's work not only with the design, but the craft of actually producing the work. There's a noticeable loss from the point of view of craftsmanship in art, of the artist that actually produces their work.
Feitura de fazer, né? que acho que, no geral, a gente está perdendo um pouco essa questão de, do artista artesão, digamos, artista que produz, né?
I guess this is a question for both of you, but how do you see art as part of the ongoing struggle to overcome racism and division in society, both in the U.S. and elsewhere?
In my opinion, art doesn't solve the problems, but it can bring the problems to light, especially to people who have the power to change things. Otherwise, it wouldn't be art, because art is always representing things, presenting. And this way, art can bring things, can create an opening for change.
I sort of agree. I feel like this is a weird time. I know in America, I don't know so much in Brazil, but in America, there's so many more artists. There's like a lot more artists in the art world now than I think there have been in a while. There's a lot more artists in grad school. There's a lot more artists just around making work. And what is now becoming the sort of problem isn't so much of change. It's just so much of what are we saying? It just seems like a lot of us are just making the work, but what are we trying to do with it? I mean, I'm kind of one of those old school moralists that there's got to be some kind of a message. I mean, yeah, it's beautiful, but what does it say? You know, or yeah, you have that skill and you can make something really well and it's great, but I don't understand. I mean, the message is lost to me. And maybe that's kind of an old school idea, but I think that's the power of art, is that it can remind us of what we are in a time. And that doesn't necessarily have to be a digital medium. It doesn't have to be something that's necessarily completely entrenched in this time. It can still be a traditional work. You can use lithography to commentate on the 21st century completely. And it's just, I think what art is most powerful in doing is just reminding us of our humanity. It's reminding us of ourselves. And like, I think now more than ever, because we're so entrenched in technology, because everyone is always looking at their cell phone and everything, it's like hard to remind ourselves of like, we're human beings. Like, you know, like, I don't know. And maybe it's an old school idea, but that's what I would like to do with my work, is to, and I'm glad, I'm honored that Sydney mentioned craft. That's so important now. Like, the human hand is important. Machinery is great. Technology is amazing. But the human hand can't be severed completely. Like, you know, you can have a really beautiful and amazing cerebral work, but if I can't feel any humanity in it, I know I can't feel a connection. And that's one thing that worries me now about art more than ever, is like it's becoming less and less about the human. It's like almost kind of like a down thing. Like, let's not talk about the fact that the human hand is present or you can see the artist's hand. Let's make it as like clean and like a Lexus. Let's make it a car.
Right.
Like, you know, let's
machine
not
made,
right
sterile.
Or just make it really clean, you know, I mean. And that, a lot of that also, as Sydney said earlier, has to do with the fact that do artists make their own work, which is also an issue today. And
what do you mean?
This is a more complicated question, because it's just like the idea of like demand and like how many artists are in demand and they have a lot of assistance. And, you know, it's just the fact of the nature of the business of art. But I think maybe there's like this old school thing. I mean, we want to see the artist's participation more. You know, I think it's kind of becoming more cool not to show so much of yourself as the artist in your work, or leave it as ambiguous as possible. And
here you both are doing self-portraits and putting your bodies and your spirits right out on.
Yeah, and we have incredible master printers who are helping us with that. You know, Bill and Kelly are just incredible. I mean, like,
yes.
You know, really incredible. And like, you know, I don't have a huge experience, you know, working with printmaking, but it's a collaboration. It's not like they're my, you know, they're working for me and they're like my assistants. Like, I am talking to them. I'm, you know, yesterday I was talking to Kelly about ideas about, oh, maybe if I try this, and she's like, oh, maybe if you try that, you know, we could do this paper here and you can do that. And that's what I really like, is like this idea of like, it's a group of people coming together and making work. Yeah, that's what real art making is about.
Now, how are you making a living in Brazil? Is it possible for an artist to make a living in Brazil as an artist where you are?
Difícil.
No, it's very hard.
Very, very hard.
Until last year, besides being an artist, I had 3 different jobs.
Mm.
This year, I have 2. It's a hard battle.
And Marge Devon joins us again, director of the Tamarind Institute. Tell us about the response that you've had from the community about this show, which has actually been, there's been several different artists. We haven't been able to interview them all because only these two are here right now, but how has the community responded to this show and to this whole project?
It's really been very rewarding for all of us. Sydney and Toyin are the third of three pairs of artists who have been here working. So we've had incredible amount of traffic. We've had great coverage in the press, and we've had a lot of people who have come in, African Americans from this community, who have come to the show once and then come back again with friends and family because it's, and what they've said to me is how important it is for them to have an opportunity to see work that really is related to them and their experiences and about them. And so for us, you know, I was so interested in hearing Toyin talk about it's about our common humanity, because I know that artists are sensitive, very sensitive. We're all sensitive to being ghettoized in some way or another. And we're all ghettoized in some way or another, whether it's by skin color, by religious affiliation, by our heritage. And I see this, in spite of that kind of sensitivity, as an opportunity to do exactly what Toyin said, which is to refer to our common humanity. I mean, looking at this work for me, too, is there's a lot of reference to feminine issues. There's a lot of reference to motherhood, to just existence as an artist. Mm. And those are things that we all share. Yeah. So it's been a great opportunity for us to educate the community in a sense, to open our doors to a wider group of people than have been here typically before. I also love hearing these two young artists talking about old school attitudes.
I know.
Because lithography was founded in 1798, and above wow. all, it is about the touch of the hand.
Yeah. And I would say morality just isn't old school. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I was reminded of that recently. Morality. It's a very old school idea.
Yeah, and it's what it's all about. Mm. Marge Devon is director of the Tamarind Institute here in Albuquerque. Toyin Odutola and Sydney Amarao are artists who are participating in this whole program that includes the exhibition Afro Black Identity in America and Brazil. The show at the Tamarind Gallery runs through the 31st of August, and there is a closing reception this Friday, the 24th of August, from 5:30 to 7 in the afternoon evening. I want to thank you all three for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And thanks also to our translator, Roberto Capocchi. Very happy now to welcome back to the show John Kloss. He's a dancer, musician, teacher. He's founder and director of Stepology, and he's here to tell us about the third annual Santa Fe Tap Dancing Festival, which is this Friday and Saturday, August 24th and 25th, with a big performance called Tap Into the Now on Friday night at the Lensic. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte.
So how's the tap scene in Santa Fe progressing since you were here about a year ago?
I think folks are more excited about it. Seeing more of the youngsters in my classes over at NDI. And I think with the music that's involved in our show, and Elise Gent and June, I think we are being embraced by a larger section of the community now.
Right, because the African dance class that Elise Gent teaches, and there's all these local drummers who are amazing and dancers, that's a huge community at this point.
Yes, absolutely. A joyous community at that.
Now, have any of them crossed over into tap?
Perhaps a little bit, and perhaps you may see and hear some of that crossover in our show at the Lensic on Friday.
Now, last year, the show at the Lensic was extraordinary. You brought people in from all over the place. Bert Dalton is going to be there again, special musical guest, and Elise and Junjun, African dance ensemble, and drumming ensemble. Are you also bringing in some tap dancers from far and wide?
Yes. You'll see some of the usual suspects. Mark Mendonca, Channing Cook Holmes, our music director, who is also a dancer, Jason Rogers, and Sam Weber. Jason Rogers is from the L.A. area, and Sam Weber is from San Francisco. So those are our main cast members as far as the tappers go.
Now, they're from far away. How do you work with them leading up to the show?
That's a good question. Well, it's a good thing that those folks and I have known one another for, over a decade, maybe even 15 years now. So we find ourselves working together in a number of environments over time. And with those experiences, we develop a very strong rapport and camaraderie. And it really helps our creative process considerably because we have that to draw on when we meet for this very short amount of time in Santa Fe.
So do you have your choreography set?
Yes and no, and it depends. And sometimes it just depends on which way the wind blows that day.
Well, there is an improvisational part
right,
of it also.
Right. I would say the whole show itself is a big structured improvisation where, almost like a set played by jazz musicians, we may have an idea of the numbers. Actually, we have a little more structure in that we have an idea of the numbers or who's going to be on stage and featured at various times in the show and the order that's going to happen in, and even in most cases, what song they're going to be playing or dancing to, but often how long it goes and what exactly they do and where they do it, and if there's any sort of musical dialogue with any of the musicians, like the bass player or the piano player, that's always kind of special to that evening or that moment.
And there's costumes, that's part of it as well.
There's sometimes costumes. We like to dress up sometimes. You may see some interesting costumes that utilize special lighting this year.
You want to give us any hints? Can you tell us one of the musical numbers?
Oh, but Mary Charlotte, the reveal is it's so much about that number.
I'm not going to make you, but... All right. Well, anyway, or genre. Give us a genre.
Oh, well, here's the interesting thing. The piece which I'm thinking of actually spans quite a few different genres of music and dance. We could say that it involves hip-hop and classical music and perhaps even traditional East Asian music. And... the dance will involve at least tap dance, possibly a little bit of dance floor, common vernacular sort of dance that you might see, humorous dance, clowning, perhaps some African. Those things will be finalized, I think, the moment that we actually do it.
We're talking to tap dancer John Kloss. Tap dancing, as I understand it, requires the kind of music that swings, jazz swings. Can you also tap dance to other things, to classical or to Latin music, for example?
Absolutely, absolutely. And that's part of, I think, what this show is all about or what this show is expressing. And what we all feel, or the cast all feels about tap dance, is it's really not confined to any one genre or form. It grew up hand in hand with swing, which actually at the time was contemporary music. It was the contemporary music of the day. Now we're finding tap happening with all forms of music. It works great with classical music. It works great with hip hop. It works great by itself. It's not something that's confined to any one genre.
We just had a performance at the Lenzic the other night in which Cuban music with clave and conga were combined with Bach.
Yeah.
So anything is possible, and not only is it possible, sometimes it's absolutely fabulous.
Absolutely, indeed.
Now, you are both a musician and a dancer, and it's, I don't know, is it the only form? It's certainly one of the forms of dance where to be a dancer, you basically have to be a percussionist. You're kind of playing music with your feet as you're dancing.
Yes. I almost sometimes in my mind refer to the folks on this project as conceptual percussionists because, they're very, meticulous about their craft as a percussionist, about the rhythm. But by the same token, of course, they're moving and they're incorporating all these visual aspects and, lateral movement and defying gravity at times to do what they do. And involving lighting effects and costumes and all that. So it's a huge integration of all these different media or forms.
Anti-gravity really does kind of express it. It's amazing. You guys are so light on your feet, it's almost magical.
Thank you, I guess. And yeah. Part of that lightness actually comes from being really down into the floor and just manipulating that tension or manipulating those distinctions between down and up.
Would you like to do a little tap dancing for us here in the Santa Fe Baking Company?
Absolutely, that'd be fun.
Crowd is going wild here in the Santa Fe Baking Company. Now, I hear in what you're doing, I mean, I could hear an Irish jig underneath that.
Yeah, actually, those types of patterns, those rhythmic patterns that tap dancers even do now, harken to way back in the Taps family tree often. And Taps family tree, of course, has two main branches. Irish dancing and African dancing.
And so the Irish dancing, I think one of the things that's so, well, to those of us who do other kinds of dance, a little odd about Irish dancing is it seems so lower body intensive and so upper body still in comparison.
Yes, it's very rigid and very straight up and down. There was something in its evolution where they were doing that in a way that they needed to avoid being seen dancing in a certain way. So they were dancing as if somebody was looking in their window and seeing their upper body.
Is that true?
I believe so, yes.
Because I've heard that. I never knew if that was an urban legend.
No, well, I'm not a historian, but I believe that that actually is part of the story of its evolution.
So the third annual Santa Fe Tap Festival is Friday and Saturday. The big event at the Lenzic Tap Into the Now concert is Friday, August 24th at 7:30 in the evening. And what's happening on Saturday?
Saturday, starting in the morning, we have master classes with our splendid, wonderful visiting artists. There will be four different classes for a variety of ages and levels of experience. Those will be at the NDI Dance Barns at 1140 Alto Street.
And anybody can go?
Yes.
Do beginners sometimes show up?
Oh, yes. We have classes for beginners, and beginners show up, and we do have let people observe the classes as well.
Now, do you have to buy tap shoes? Do you have to make that commitment, or do some people just show up in their cowboy boots and decide later if they're going to splurge?
Well, yes, they do. And the highest quality experience will be had by those who do it in tap shoes. But of course, you know, folks will be able to have a quality of experience and enjoy themselves in any number of types of footwear, even in their bare feet. It depends on how they approach the class.
John Kloss is dancer, musician, teacher, founder and director of Stepology. Stepology is on the web at stepology.com. And people can get their tickets by calling the Lenzic 505-988-1234 or going to ticketssantafe.org. John, thank you so much, and we will see you on Friday night.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. Take care.
I'd like now to welcome to the program Latin DJ Patrick Noble. He's here to talk to us about the Albuquerque Latin Dance Fest and Latin music. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So we've had you on a number of times over the years talking about Latin music, and it's funny, in 2 weeks, basically, we're having two major Cuban dance bands in northern New Mexico. It's an embarrassment of riches. Last week we had Tiempo Libre,
Tiempo
and now
Libre.
This week in Albuquerque, the Latin Dance Fest, Timba Life.
Right, Timba Live, which is a phenomenal band that I first saw Timba Live, I guess it was February 2011 in San Francisco at the Salsa Rueda Festival in San Francisco, which is the biggest festival of its kind right now, you know, attended by well over 1,000 people. And
they ripped it up.
They ripped it up. You know, I tell people this story about Timba Live that a lot of bands, you hear their CD and then you see them live and you're like, yeah, but, you know, the sound was a little off and, you know, there's something was just like the CD was smoother, you know, it was more polished and
right. That happens all the time.
Yeah. It's kind of rough live because of things that happen live. The opposite was the case when I saw Timba Live in concert. I'd heard their CD and I was like, yeah, you know, it's pretty good. And as a DJ, I'd play it. I'd get requests for it. I mean, they're definitely popular. But then I saw them live, and they outplayed their CD by far. And
amazing.
I was blown away. I was like...
Now, the Albuquerque Latin Dance Festival is also quite an unusual thing to have a festival of this size and caliber in northern New Mexico. It's happening, let's see, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, starting this Thursday, the 23rd of August. What's it all about?
Yeah, this is... kind of the dream of a few dedicated individuals who put this together. Guanabana Productions is ultimately behind it. But it's a festival. It's workshop. It's 3 days of workshops, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. They're workshops all day. They're bringing in instructors from all over, including some of our local talent from Santa Fe.
Yay.
Darren and Tony.
Yep.
And yeah.
Who were recently featured, ladies and gentlemen, in the Santa Fe Reporter a couple of weeks ago. The cover story of the Reporter was about salsa and Latin dance in Santa Fe.
Right, right. So this is nice, you know, that it's all following on the heels of this. And they're also bringing in instructors from Colorado, and I don't know where some of these other people are from, but the schedule's all on their website, which is... abqlatinfest.com, or if you can't remember that, it's abqldf.com.
If you Google any combination of those things, you will find it.
It'll get you there. So it's 3 days of workshops, and they're really some great classes. I'm looking forward to taking some of them. Eric Freeman is coming down from Boulder, Colorado. He's a phenomenal instructor and one of the first guys to go to Cuba with a video camera and start breaking down some of the stuff that people were doing and bring it back and start teaching it.
One of the things that's so interesting as somebody who has also studied Latin dance is sometimes, I mean, you're watching people who are from Cuba and they know how to do these things that you can only dream of doing, but they don't really know how to break it down for you. And sometimes there's an American who goes and studies this stuff, videotapes it, puts it in slow motion, puts one foot forward at the speed of sound or whatever, slowly, and pretty soon you master it, but you kind of need that person to teach you if you don't have that in your blood.
Right, right. Just because you're a good dancer doesn't mean you're a good teacher.
Yeah. Right.
And then the other events going on in addition to the classes with the Albuquerque Latin Dance Festival, there are a few different things, but I'll talk first about the parties, because everyone likes to party. And those are Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and I believe there's one Sunday too. But kind of the two big events are Friday night and Saturday night. Friday night, the festival takes over the Old Town Plaza in Albuquerque.
Wow.
And puts down four dance floors all around the gazebo, which is in the center of the plaza there.
Oh my goodness.
And
so you can see the dance, the band from any...
Right.
Vantage point.
And they're going to do the stages a little different this year, I understand. Last year, the band did play in the gazebo. I'm not sure if that's going to be the case this year.
Okay.
But there's plenty of space. It's outdoors, under the stars, and there are hundreds of people. It gets really well attended, and it's a lot of fun. Yvonne Ulaberry and Cafe Mocha are going to be playing. I'm going to be DJing when they're not playing. And then there's also after parties. The Saturday night is considered the main event, and that's at the National Hispanic Cultural Center, also outdoors, and that's with this band Timba Live that we were talking about.
Right.
And they're going to be performing, and just, it's, a band like this hasn't been to New Mexico in a long time.
So, like the band that was here last week, the Lensic, these guys are Cuban, but based in Miami.
Mm-hmm. Correct, yeah.
And they're playing this kind of music, which is called Timba.
They playing timba. They're all phenomenal musicians, educated in the Cuban music education system, which produces monsters like Gonzalo Rubalcaba and
right.
these many other examples. And they're playing timba, which is contemporary Cuban popular dance music.
Which we came in with and which we'll go out with in just a moment. So let's see. People can just look it up. There's parties every night. Thursday, Friday, Saturday. There's a milonga also on Saturday, and there's a Sunday wrap-up party. So lots of good things. And there's also films going on.
Films and lectures. Eric Freeman, who we were talking about, I was thinking he's giving a lecture on Saturday about the history of salsa throughout the world and kind of tracing some of the diaspora and the evolution of salsa. And he's a dancer fundamentally, so he's going to be demonstrating some dance steps in his lecture.
Patrick Noble is a DJ, also known as P.A. Trix. He's a Latin music DJ, and great fun to have you on the air. And you're going to be out there not only DJing, but dancing yourself.
Yes, I'll be doing both. I'm looking forward to it.
The Albuquerque Latin Dance Festival is at abqlatinfest.com, and we're going to go out with more music by Timba Live.
Thanks.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafemc. My email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org, and we're on Twitter at radiocafemc. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, jazz. Ahí es la esencia de mi tierra, lo que me corre por la